Go Loud presents Murder Most Irish. Find it first on the Go Loud app and on all major podcast platforms.
Valentine.
I'm very good, my Valentine.
I am your only Valentine. Your husband is not your Valentine.
Hello, Mother. Say hello to Sarah Jane.
Hello, Sarah Jane.
Hi, Kathleen.
You look very well, Sarah Jane.
I'm in my pyjamas.
Sarah always has the nicest pyjamas.
Yeah, they're lovely, Sarah Jane.
Like, they look like an outfit when
I'm really particular about pyjamas because it's a stigma in Ballyferma, Kathleen, and we're trying to break it.
I see people down here going into the local shop in pyjamas.
No, I wouldn't do that, but I do make sure that the ones I wear look like an outfit.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's terrible.
Mam's a classist. Listen, leave this in, Colin.
Please leave all of that in.
All of that in, Kathleen. Or Mam, or Colin, yeah. I've decided I'm your only Valentine and your husband is not your Valentine.
Okay. Am I correct in thinking this is cancelled as deck? Yeah, no, you are. Sorry, people in work are messaging me about stupid shit. What a day. It's Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to everybody.
The heart of St. Valentine is in the city centre.
That's crazy.
Yeah, well, I think there's two St. Valentines. I think there's one somewhere else in the world where people are like, we've got the heart. And then we have, you know, on, what's the name of that street? It's between Georgia Street and Camden Street.
Is that Delir Street?
Well, it's a Whitefriars Church or something like that.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, that's the one which I thought was a cult for the longest time. Turns out it's not.
No, it's a Catholic church, but they have the heart of St. Valentine.
They have a bookstore beside that, actually, if anybody ever wants to find a little secondhand used bookstore. They have a fabulous little bookstore in there. Sorry, I'm trying to turn off everything. How are you? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm very good. It's Valentine's Day and I'm going out to paint pottery with Graham tonight. And then after this, I'm going to go have a shower and get the kids ready and go to dancing. And then I'm going
to
come back.
I thought you to go to dancing.
Fridays are such a day for me. And then they're not, because I get to dancing and I wait around. But I still am working while I'm waiting around. So I always feel like I've got this heightened, like I'm doing... Like, you know, I'm like doing things.
Yeah, you're waiting for other stuff to happen. I hate that. Like, there's that thing where people talk about executive dysfunction, where, and I do this and I didn't know that I did this. When I have something, so say it's a day and I have something on at 3 p.m. Like, I cannot function. I'm like, all I'm doing is being like, I have to do that thing at 3 p.m. I have to do that thing. Like, it's the only thing I'm thinking about.
Yeah, well, I see these things on the internet and they're like, you suffer with executive dysfunction. And in my head, I go, no, that's just not how, that's how everybody thinks.
Yeah, but I don't.
Because I don't know any different.
Yeah, that's true.
So because I'm just like, that's how everybody thinks.
Because I don't think Colin will do loads of stuff before he has to do something. Whereas my brain is like, I have to do that thing at 3 p.m. So I can't do that and I can't do that.
But yeah, then I'm like, you have it at a higher level, I think, than me. I can do things, but I'm really stressed about them. And I have like a ball in the center of my chest for the day with everything I am doing, except that thing that I've organized or planned or whatever. Because I'm like, oh, I've got to go. I've got to check the time. Whereas I think I do say to you, do you want to do the thing? You're like, no, I've got to. Like, I've a Tesco's delivery coming at 8 o'clock. And I'm like, it's 11 o'clock in the morning. What are you talking about?
It's the day before, Emma. No, I do. I literally panic. Like, I'm like, no, I've got to do that thing. I've got to do that thing. And I hate that I do that. And I know that I'm like that since I was a kid. Like, I remember being like that as a kid. Like, and then I don't know if you got this, but if you had, like, when you were a kid, if you had something to do the next day, like, my nervous anxiety, like, my tummy would be sick.
It depends on what I have to do.
Anything for me.
No, it's not anything. But if it's generally like now, as I've gotten older, it's like if I've got to do something in work that I don't really enjoy, or I know I'm going to have like an argument, or I think everybody's like that again.
Yeah, I think
like I would do that thing where I'm totally fine. Like I'd be like to you, oh, I'm fine.
Yeah,
fine,
you do fine. That thing where you're like, everything's great and I'm okay and everything's great and I'm fine.
And then I get into bed and I'm awake at 4 a.m. being
and
like,
I know you're not fine. I'm like, this bitch is losing her mind.
I know. And I've lost like, I went to the hospital today and they were like, you've lost like, it was quite like a high number. I think they said like 8 or 9 kilos. I don't know if that's a high number. Anyway, I don't pay attention to that shit. So when she said it to me, I was like, oh, okay. And then when I was thinking about it, it's cause like when I'm stressed or I'm stuff I'm worried about, I like I have that fight or flight. Like my body is like emptying out all everything in your body.
Oh yeah.
Like remember I kept saying to you, I can't stop shitting.
Yeah.
That's just because I'm stressed.
You're stressed. No, I get that. When I'm stressed, the first thing I do when I'm stressed is like shit. Like immediately, our ancestors are like, empty your bowel. You'll be lighter. You can run faster from the danger.
Yeah. Like, so, like sometimes in work, I'd have to go like a meeting I do every week, and just before I go into it, I have like a little, oh, I just need to do poo.
What is that? Like, you know what else I get that when I'm getting tattooed.
I don't really get that when I'm getting tattooed.
I do get that when I'm getting tattooed because
I just get sad right before I'm getting tattooed, and you have to put up with me.
Why are we doing this? But if I'm getting like a big tattoo, like when Keelan was doing my back, I was constantly having to go to the bathroom because I was like, this is going to hurt so much. But like when I got the little one on my leg, I was like, no, that's fine. That doesn't bother me. But if it's like a big thing that I know I'm going to be sat there for hours, I'm like, oh God.
Yeah, no, it's
just all the poop out of your body.
Yeah, it just depends. Wait, did I show you this thing on Skype the last time? I do this thing at work. Rachel got me.
It's like a stress reliever thing?
No, it's a sticky thing for sticking your phone to things. Right? Very good. And if I stick this to this, I can stick my phone here.
Oh!
I can stick my phone to anything. Right? But in work, we've loads of like box glass meeting rooms, and when you throw this, it sticks. So I've got really good at throwing it. But look, I just threw it at the camera.
Oh, look, the camera's gone off.
And I do this sometimes in meetings, and I don't want people to see me. But so yeah, I was like, isn't this cool? But Rachel has one, and the reason she got me this one is because I kept taking her one and throwing it up to really high areas in the building. Yeah,
that's don't do that. There's a part of your brain that is like, it cannot, like, this is what Graham is always like, don't ever let Sarah near a gun. And I fully agree with him. Like, I'm like, yeah, no, don't ever let Sarah near a gun.
No, I can't. Like
whenever
I
see those videos of people, you know, people are like, especially non-Americans who go to America and they're in the airport and there's police with guns and they're like, when the intrusive thoughts take over, and he's just like looking at the gun. Gonna grab it. I'm like, that is Sarah.
Honestly, I just can't.
And
I don't
like, even a crack. I was only for a laugh.
What a lesson. yeah, no, honestly, I can't. Like, and there's been times where I do things and I can see it acting out in slow motion as I do it.
Yeah.
But I can't stop myself. I don't know what that is.
I don't know. It's you. Like, I've seen you, like, with those, like, you know, those pet, like, those guns that with the little thingies. What are they called?
The Nerf guns. Or the pellet guns.
Like, I've seen you aim that at Graham's head and be like, I'm like, sir, don't do that. And you can't not do it. And he knows it's coming. Like, he has no power over any of this. Like, Graham.
Never tell me the time I locked him out the back.
No.
So we used to, you know, our old back door, the way you could only open it and close it from the inside.
Oh, yeah.
And he was out the back hanging up clothes. And we'd like gotten Lily Nerf guns for Christmas. And it wasn't even at Christmas, but I was cleaning the room and I found like the guns. And I came down the stairs and locked the door really quietly. And then went up the stairs to the back window and hung out the back window. And I had one of these. It's called a turret. So it's like 100 bullets in it. And it's like, and I was just shooting them. Because he'd nowhere to go. Like, couldn't go anywhere.
Domestic abuse.
And I'm sure anybody from the outside looking in. But it's like that thing today you sent me that voice note where you said Graham came down the stairs.
Yeah, like, you just came down the stairs. And I feel bad because I laugh and then I'm like, I feel so bad. But you just walk downstairs and I don't even think we were talking about him. And you just went to him, me and Emma were talking about you. And he goes, why? And you just went, because you're a fucking idiot. And he was so offended. And I was like, I don't even think we were talking about you.
Oh, it's from that, you know, that clip I said, what is the name? Is that called Vice Principals or something, that show?
Oh, I need to watch that show.
Do you know, that show is like every show that that guy's in. What's that guy? Not Walton Goggins. Danny McBride makes shows where they're not funny.
Colin, right? The funniest man alive.
No, he is funny, but his shows do this thing where they're like really dark at times.
Yeah, like he makes that really... that humor that you're like, I'm so uncomfortable.
Yeah, and then that show, Vice Principals, and there are bits of that are absolutely hilarious. But when you do all of the funny bits together, it looks like a really funny show. Like that, Walton Goggins in that, like Graham just be like, that is you.
That is
you are this man.
Like when you get, and when you go into Sarah, we call Sarah gets into these moods, we call it the mean moods, where she, like, it's like when she's overstimulated to a point where her brain shuts down and she just has to be mean.
Yeah.
Mean. Like, and I'm like, we have to get you out of this room immediately. Take her away from the situation.
Sometimes it happens in work. It's bad.
Punch someone in the mouth.
Yeah, sometimes in work it happens. And I've learned now. But what someone said to me a little while ago, oh, fucking, someone was talking about somebody. And I just went, no, they're like, it was like a fucking like feedback session. And I was like, I don't have any feedback. And they were like, really? And I was like, no, the only thing I think about that person is they're a cunt.
Yeah, like we've been in situations where I'm like, okay, we're leaving. Because I know I can smell, like I can feel it coming off you.
Yeah, no, it's bad.
I also hate, as I was saying to Colin the other day, I wish I was one of those people that couldn't read people's moods.
Graham. Do you mean Graham?
Sometimes I wish I was like that because, yeah, because sometimes it's so heightened that I know sometimes I'm projecting and the person is not actually mad, angry, sad, or any of those things. They're just existing and being normal. But like I read it so much that like I can feel a shift. I think you're quite.
Yeah. I'm similar.
Yeah, and I'm like, I fucking hate. And Colin is Colin can, like, he didn't used to be like that. Colin could never read a room, ever read a room. But he's gotten more like he can. He's like, I can sense when someone's not getting me too. I fucking hate it. I wish I was one of those people that was like, I thought they were grand.
Yeah, no, there's like
that.
I can feel like the tiniest,
yep,
minuscule shift in someone, yep, and it's awful in work. I hate it.
Yeah.
Because I work in a tiny little job, there's not many of us, and I notice everything, and it becomes like I then start to like I immediately do that thing that people that have like ADD or what's that, executive dysfunction, is that what we call it, where I'm like, oh, they hate me.
Yeah,
they hate me.
Yeah,
like me. And I wish I didn't care, because I can do that
that's
thing
it. Maybe
I get really good
it.
Where I can do that thing where I'm like, I don't care.
Maybe that's what I wish. Maybe that's the thing.
Yeah. Like, whereas Graham genuinely does not care what people think about him.
I wish I was like that sometimes.
And I actually, maybe that is the thing. I don't think he, I think he doesn't care so much that he doesn't pay attention.
Yeah.
It's not important to him.
That's it. I do wish I had a little bit of that. Because like you, my last job, it was so small, tiny little job. And like you could, I'd walk into the office and I'd know immediately like if something was wrong. Or if someone's emailing me and there's even the slightest shift in how they're sending the email, I'm like, what have I done? What have I done?
Like, but I also just think that sometimes just comes from like working somewhere where maybe like, it's like, here's the thing. I know we've talked about it. It's not like, I don't want to work. I want to do this.
I want to work.
I want to do this all day.
I do this all day.
Like, I
think people who want to work are quite admirable. Like that idea of like, I want, like, oh, I, by the way, everybody, I got a job, which is great. But like at the same time, I'm like, I don't, you know, when you're in an interview and they're like, why do you want this job? I'm like,
money.
Brother, I don't want this job.
Yeah.
I want cheddar. I want moolah.
Like
books.
I had, I was interviewing someone the other day, and I've gotten, like, you know me, I'm good at interviewing. I'm actually phenomenally good at interviewing. And I did say to Graham a little while ago, if I could do that as a job where I just interview all the time, I'd actually be really okay with that, because I really enjoy interviewing. But I think maybe I should be a salesperson, because that is just a sales pitch. But anyway, before we psychoanalyze me any further, there's someone, I was interviewing someone today, and at the end of the interview, I was like, what's your salary expectations? And the guy was like, kind of, and I just went to him, listen, there's no right or wrong answer here. You tell me how much money you want.
Yeah.
And I then tell you if I can do that or not.
Exactly.
I was like, I was like, Irish people are so humble when it comes to this.
Yeah.
I was like, and I used to be like that. I was like, but there is just no, it's just unnecessary. The person going in for the interview to interview somebody has a salary range in mind. And if you're like way out of that, they're going to tell you immediately, we can't offer that, because they won't bring you through to second round.
Yeah.
And if you're under it, they're not going to say anything. So you just need to make sure that you've, one, checked to see how much money this role is actually worth, and two, whatever the mid range of that is, you can live on. Like, and then just go from there. And the guy was like, I was interviewing with someone else, and the guy just went to me, oh, okay. And I was like, there's no need for, I was like, I don't need you to be embarrassed. I don't need you to be awkward. Yeah. I just need you to give me a figure. And he was like, thanks so much for set. Like, he was like, I always get really, and I was like, everybody does.
But they everybody do gets uncomfortable. Because that, but that should be the conversation. That should be what the person says. Hey, we're asking you this for the purposes of, we need to know what you're looking for. We're not trying to catch you out. We're not trying to make you feel bad. You're not begging us for money, but we Irish people are so uncomfortable around the conversations of money. It just is. It's in us. We're like, you know, when in certain countries where when you meet someone, one of the first things they'll ask you is like, what do you do?
Yeah.
We don't do that, because we find those conversations really gauche. We don't like them. Like, no. I would never ask someone how much money they make. Like, I wouldn't in a million years ever say anything. Like, we stop. But yeah, like, even that my interview, when they asked me, I was like, oh, I fucking hate this. But like, if the interviewer had said what you said, I would have been so comfortable.
Yeah, I was just like, yeah, dude.
That's cool. But that's like, nice that, you know, you're so honest about it. And it's a lot of what interviewing should be is putting people at ease, because you want them to be comfortable to work in your company. Like, yeah, you want them to know that that's what they're walking into. But
honestly, that is it. And even this thing, I was messing at work today, and I was saying to Denise, I was like, these LinkedIn updates have gotten out of hand. And she was like, what do you mean by that? And I was like, Barbara is pleased to announce that she's completed a PDF course that took 15 seconds and now has achieved the highest ranking on the blah blah, which allows her to use the Franken machine once a week. Thanks for all your support. I was like, people on LinkedIn need to calm the fuck down. Oh, that was multiple LinkedIn choice. It took you 2 minutes. Yeah. Like, and you chat.
I can't. LinkedIn. Oh, I fucking hate LinkedIn. Because the thing about it is, everybody is full of shit. Like, they're just full of shit. Like, nobody gives a fuck about this. I'm pleased to announce that I'm now the vice president of the vice president of the vice president of the secretary of the vice president. Shut the fuck up. Like,
oh, I'm pleased to announce that I've invented the word synergy plusinergy.
Honestly. Like, I'm pleased to announce that I regularly shit on company time. They are paying me to take a shit, and it's Rehu. Like,
honestly, I'm pleased to announce that I leave my job every day bang on 5:30.
Yeah, when that, like, when that fucking long hand hits that fucking, I'm gone. Like,
yeah, like, I just, like, I said it to her today and she was howling, and I was like, she was like, who's Barbara? And I was like, I made Barbara update.
I'm Barbara up. Right? Oh god.
Like,
it's like when you're showing your mom a meme and she's like, who's that? I don't know who that is.
You know who does that to me?
Who?
Graham.
Yeah.
When I tell you Graham is 175 years of age, like, before his time, it is so infuriating. Graham rolls over his head and he looks over my shoulder and he goes,
I know, fuck out of here.
Who's that? What do you mean, who's that? I'm looking at the FYP page. I don't know. Like, the fuck?
Oh, Graham's fucking catching strays here all the
like, honestly, he drives me. His new thing is, by the way, this is what I got him for Valentine's Day, because this is his new thing. Lily got one of these 2 years ago as a Christmas present off someone, and she never opened it. And when she was sick last week, Graham opened it and was like, maybe you'd like to do that while you're unwell and you're not in school. She did it for, like, I need to actually bring Lily to, like, a psychologist. She did it for about 10 seconds and then said to me, I'm bored. I don't want to do that. And I was like, okay. It is this crystal art.
Hold that thing up so I can take a picture. Done. Go on.
Right. So it's this crystal art thing and, oh, it's upside down. You can't even tell. Anyway.
Oh, is that like the little sticky thingy, is it?
Yeah. So Graham came down after college then early, like late last week. And it was on the table and he started to do it. And now it's like, he was like, he's obsessed. He comes down every evening after college and he sits at, he puts on an Odie. He sits at the table and he eats digestive biscuits and drinks tea and does this crystal art. And I was like to Graham, you know, they're going in the bin when they're complete. Like, they're, I'm not, I don't know what you think I'm doing with this.
But like, it's obviously shutting his brain down a little bit.
When he said it's his brain, because after college, he does struggle because he's so stressed about college.
Yeah.
Even though he's nothing to be stressed about. So he says it really turns his brain off. But I am tempted now because he's got three of them. I am tempted to start like a crystal art wall. I think that'd be so tacky. That'll be cool.
I kind of think that would be the most amazing thing ever.
Like, just a whole load of them.
Just a whole load of them stuck to the wall.
But anyway, that's his new.
It probably does like help things like that. I think help people just kind of shut off.
Yeah, he said it's helping. He is very stressed. And I don't know. He's doing really well in college, but he just he just doesn't think he's capable at every fucking avenue, and it drives me insane. Like, I have to. I know I've spoken about him, but like when he. Graham has to repeat things to me over and over again because he has to say them out loud.
Okay.
So he talks to me about college at least once a day. And he says the same thing that he said the day previous.
Like, oh, so is he just trying to kind of get it into his head? Or is it like a comfort thing where he's like, okay, I've said that out loud now and somebody else knows what I'm saying?
I think it's a comfort thing where, see, I don't operate at that like that at all. You know me. If I'm stressed about something, I'm not talking about it.
No, you shut down.
Yeah. And then I'm like, I'll get to the thing and I'll do it. And then once it's done, because I know the outcome, then I talk about it.
Which makes sense, like in some respects, that you're not putting too much on yourself. You know what I mean?
I just do. You know when people are, I always think when people are going for their driving tests and they start to tell people, I wouldn't tell anybody.
I wouldn't tell anybody.
Because I don't want the added pressure of, or even, do you know when you were looking for a job and you were interviewing, every time you interviewed, Graham would literally, like every day, he'd be like, how's she getting on? How, like, did she get an offer? Or even that other job where you didn't get the offer and you went for all the interviews. He was like, did she ask for feedback? And I was like, Graham, I don't ask her any of these questions. And he was like,
thing where it's like, I'm the exact same, where it's like, you already are under pressure with it.
Yeah, I don't want to ask you or stress you out any further.
Yeah, and that's the thing where I kind of let you come to me when I'm like, I'll let her tell me.
Such a lying sack of shit. You'll be texting me. Hold on, I times a day. Are you okay?
I'm usually right. Aren't I usually right?
I know.
I am. I can fucking smell it. I swear to God. I'm like, something's up with that one and she's not telling me. I'm totally fine. And then two days later, I had a full-blown nervous breakdown. I was rocking back and forth in my bathroom. Like, I always know.
So I'm watching Gossip Girl again.
With stuff like job interviews and stuff like that, I'm never what's going on? How'd you get, like, I'm like, you tell me when you want to tell me, like, because I don't want to be. And also sometimes you just don't want to talk about that shit. You just like,
But Graham's brain does not operate that way. No. So Graham would be like, hey.
Studied in a fucking science, in a lab.
I'm telling you, I know last time we made the podcast, I said that you studied from, like, the Royal Tenenbaums. That's not me, like, I'm married to this man.
Yeah.
Like, he keeps telling me this crystal art set, by the way, that he is doing that Lily got 2 years ago, is missing one set of crystals. So there's one color.
Yeah.
Every day. It's missing a set of crystals. I don't know why you keep telling me. I couldn't give a fuck. Like, I don't care.
Like, it's 2 years old, Graham.
I said, look in her drawer. Where you found it. He was like, yeah, I will. Every day.
Every day.
I don't give a shit. I said, I'm going to throw this fucking crystallized French bulldog in the bin as soon as it finishes.
Oh, I saw that on the table the day that I was over that Lily wasn't feeling well.
Yeah.
I was like, what is this? And she was like, Alicia bought that for me for like 2 years ago.
Yeah. Now Graham is.
Now your father is having an autistic moment with it at the kitchen table. Like, for. Oh, Sarah Jane.
What?
Mention our news.
Housekeeping.
Yeah. About the show?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Okay, we'll give a vague. So the lovely Laughter Lounge have gotten back to us. Sarah Jane and I did not think that was going to happen. and want us to do a show. So we're hoping to do a show on July 24th in the Laughter Lounge. Sorry, it's in Dublin again. But here's why we're doing it in Dublin. We don't have to pay for the show. So that's one of the main reasons. The other reason being, obviously, we actually had a really nice time the last time and we enjoyed ourselves. So, well, I did. So we're Sarah was
happy. I'm looking at her to the camera.
Nervous breakdown. Like,
what is this lie you are telling?
I had a great time.
I spent fucking 4 hours of my life stimming.
Walking like a Korean grandfather. If you don't know what I mean by that. Is there's like memes online of Korean grandfathers who walk around with their hands linked behind their backs. For 2.5 hours, she walked around the venue like that. And I was like, what is going on with Sarah Jane? She's having a breakdown. So we're hoping to do a show 24th of July. We don't have everything set in stone at the moment, but as soon as we do, we'll put up links. And if you would like to come and see us, we would love to see you. So it's up to you. But yeah, I'm really bad at selling stuff. Do you want to do our case?
Yeah, we should probably do that.
Hey, you! Yes, you! Are you sick of being got at by boredom? Well, Sarah Jane and Emma know the perfect remedy for you. A subscription to the official Murder Most Irish Patreon. For only €6 a month, you can not only support the show, but binge out on exclusive weekly content. Murder Most Irish Patreon for all your murder feminist needs.
You're going to be mad at me.
Yeah, why?
Cause. It's a blue ball case.
You can fucking, I'm not listening.
Like, no, it's very interesting because I know it's going to irritate you for various reasons. So
okay.
I'm always, whenever I'm doing, I love doing a case where I'm like, oh, this is going to piss Sarah off. For various reasons, not just the blue ball nature of it, but for other various reasons.
Is it because I'm funny when I'm annoyed?
Yeah, and because you say things that I think but wouldn't say. Okay. If that makes sense.
Okay.
I'm like, I wouldn't say that, but Sarah can say it. So I'm trying to think if there's necessary trigger warnings in this episode. Not really. No, there's nothing graphic. There's nothing graphic in this episode. Obviously, there's mentions of somebody, the disappearance of a loved one. So obviously, if that's upsetting to you, you know. Step back, but everything else is pretty much standard.
So if that upsets you and triggers you, don't listen to any of our episodes.
Don't listen to any of our episodes. Okay, so I got my references. I have so many references. I'll just put them up, but the main references that I got it from are The Independent and T.G. Cahir. Everything else I will put up on the show notes because there's so many of them. So this week I am covering the disappearance and the murder, which is what the Gardaí have determined this case as, of a lady called Sandra Collins. And this entire thing takes place in a little place called Killala in County Mayo, which I've never heard of.
I have been to Killala.
Have you been to Killala?
Yeah.
It looks really beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's up beside the sea. So Killala in County Mayo is a small picturesque village some 6 kilometres north of Ballina. In the year 2000, the population of the seaside town was a mere 657 people. Like, it is tiny. Like most small areas in Ireland, this meant that everybody knew everybody else. They knew your private business, and anything that was private never remained as such. There's an inherent kindness and connection with villagers. The need to keep the area clean, hospitable, and also safe are tantamount, and any upset within this structure can cause a devastating effect throughout the community. So December 4th, the year 2000, on a cold evening, as the waves licked the shore of Killala Bay, 29-year-old Sandra put on a fleece coat, her scarf and gloves and called out goodbye as she left her aunt Anne O'Grady's house. Anne was somebody that Sandra cared for. She was her full-time carer. So Sandra left to go to Bahrain's shop to buy some groceries. The walk was only 3 minutes from the house on Courthouse Road, so Sandra's aunt expected her back quite quickly. A little while later, Bridie Collins, Sandra's sister, received a call from Anne. She told Bridie that Sandra had not returned home and she was concerned. Bridie, knowing Sandra sometimes went to visit friends, told her aunt not to worry, that she would be home soon. Now, Bridie told T.G. Cahir that the reason she told her aunt not to worry is because she thought maybe Sandra was a grown woman. She thought maybe Sandra had gone out to a party or gone out to meet up with friends because her aunt mentioned that she took a shower and put on makeup before she left.
So
she kind of like, that's why Bridie was like, listen, she's fine, because she kind of thought she's gone out. She's a grown woman. She can fucking go out with her mates. She can go out to a party. And maybe Bridie thought maybe she just didn't want to tell her aunt where she was going. So she was like, she didn't worry. Sandra's family weren't too concerned. They understood that Sandra had a social life outside of her aunt. Her brother Patrick thought maybe Sandra had had an argument with her aunt and that that could have been the reason Sandra decided to go out and stay out. So from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. that night, no one saw Sandra. At 11:10, she entered the Country Kitchen Cafe in Kalala. It was windy outside. Her hair was askew. She ordered one large bag of chips, put them under her coat, and Sandra said to the staff she looked normal, she was well-dressed and was her usual pleasant, courteous self. At 11:20 p.m., Sandra Collins left the cafe and she would never be seen again. On the 14th of December 1971, a little girl was born to Eleanor and Francie, who lived in the small village of Fotish in County Mayo. I think I'm saying that right. Fotish. She was the couple's first child and they named her Sandra. In a few short years, her brother James and sister Bridie would arrive. Tragically, in 1987, their father Francie passed away, but in the mid-80s, Eleanor met and married Joe Collins, and they went on to have three children together, Patrick, David and Mary. The six Collins grew up in the quaint townland. In their village, there was only 12 cottages. Like, this place was friggin' tiny. Their childhood was a happy one. The family were exceptionally close and felt safe and secure in Fotish. Bridie said the siblings loved each other dearly and shared everything. Patrick, Sandra's younger brother, said, "We were lucky because not only were we siblings, but we were each other's best friends." Can relate, but also can't relate.
Yeah.
Because we used to fucking kill each other. So Sandra's sisters and brothers remembered her as the kindest person they knew. She was always thinking of others before herself. As the oldest, she became their confidant and carer. Whenever someone fell and hurt themselves, whenever they needed someone to talk to, they went straight to Sandra. She adored her siblings. Video footage showed Sandra with Patrick when he was 6 years old. As an interviewer speaks to them outside of an event in the town, Sandra introduces Patrick and smiles down at him, rubbing his shoulders to keep him calm. "She was so caring," Patrick said, "and she would kill me for saying this, but my God, was she competitive." Her brothers remembered playing cards with her and just letting her win because it was easier to deal with.
No.
So at the age of 16, now this is very upsetting to me, but maybe, and I, because I'm looking at it through the eyes of someone that lives in 2025. I'm not looking at it through the eyes of someone who lives in the early, late 80s and early 90s. But anyway, at the age of 16, Sandra moved in with her aunt, Anne O'Grady. Anne had been diagnosed with chronic arthritis, and Sandra decided to step up and help. Bridie said this was Anne's decision and that the family were not shocked she agreed to it due to her kind nature. Although Sandra was only meant to spend a few weeks with Anne, the weeks turned into months and the months turned into years. And at the time of her death, she was still living with Anne.
Right. Is that upsetting to you because she's 16?
Yes.
Well, that's my mom's life. My mom left school when she was 14 because her mum had rheumatoid arthritis. And back then, there's like literally no treatment for it.
No help.
And it's not only is it debilitating because you start to lose mobility, it's incredibly painful.
And then
the only treatment you have is pain management. And the pain management is quite severe. Back then, in particular, it's really severe. You're talking morphine.
Yeah. And it was like opioids probably were.
Yeah, you're on an awful lot of opioids. Your mood swings are quite severe. But that is common for, that's common for its time.
That's what I mean. And I think that's why this upsets me, is because I'm looking at it through the lens of someone who's living in 2025. And there is a level of like privilege that I have that to never have experienced this. But it just upsets me that. She was this.
It is odd that she was offered out of the family.
Yeah, like she, but her sister said that she wanted to do it. So, you know, I would never argue with that. That's what Bridie said. This is her sister. But yeah, like, and I'll read a little bit on more here as to why it is quite upsetting. So Bridie said their mother missed Sandra, but also understood that her sister Anne needed her more. Although an exceptionally altruistic act, living with Anne must have been difficult for Sandra. Not only did she not finish school, Yeah. She was young, caring for someone, and living in a one-bedroom cottage where she used to sleep on the sofa, which was situated right beside the kitchenette. Like, that's really fucking upsetting to me.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm being a bit dramatic about it, but, like...
No, I think it speaks to the time, and I think it also speaks to the time in terms of, like, our healthcare system.
Exactly.
Like, no, you know, there's no... And actually, that still exists. A lot of people who end up becoming dependent on their family members for home help. Like, there isn't a home help grant to, like, build an extra bedroom on for your carer. Well,
you're like,
there's a home help grant on to build, like, something for you if you need it for, like, your mobility. But like, no, not to that. So like, I know that, you know, that little boy that was shot in Ballyferma and is now in a wheelchair.
Yes.
I know his mom sleeps in the sitting room of their house with him because he has to have a hospital bed. And and she sleeps on the sofa. And that was how many years ago? And she still does.
That's so upsetting. Like, that just upsets me so much. Like, I don't know. Like, when I was reading this, doing research for this, obviously I'm not saying anything about Sandra's family. It just, it's not their fault, but it just, I was like, oh my God, she's 16 years old. Oh, so Bridie remembered Sandra telling her she missed her siblings and her mother and the feeling of being around a large family. But she felt if she left Anne, she would be letting her down. So unfortunately, that does create that thing where you feel like you don't have an option. Because you're like, I can't let the sick person be without. So David, Sandra's brother, admits that he knows Sandra gave up the best years of her life. The years that she should have been in school, making friends, having fun, socializing and learning how to be a teenager. She also gave up the best years of her adult life, he said. Sandra spent most of her days with Anne and also as well, like this girl was so sweet, and she cared for her elderly neighbors as well. She became known in the area for walking to and from the shops with groceries for them. So she would go and knock on her elderly neighbor's doors and be like, do you need anything? Like 16? Sandra's life with Anne was not an easy one. So Anne was controlling and expected Sandra to do exactly as she said. Maybe her fear of Sandra leaving one day had led to this. Her family said they did not believe Sandra was happy and that she was instead putting on a brave face. Sandra and Anne would visit the Collinses every Sunday, and Bridie said she believed this was the only time Sandra was truly happy. Anne's control of Sandra continued into her 20s. She would tell Sandra where she could go and when she could go and with whom. So when, you know, Anne called Bridie to be like, Sandra hasn't come home, Bridie was obviously like, well, she's okay, she's fine. But Bridie also knew, like, this girl has to have her own life. Leave her alone.
Yeah.
Sandra did develop somewhat of a social life, attending local pubs and sometimes meeting men in the area. However, her brother Patrick described her as someone who was quite naive and vulnerable, so the possibility of Sandra being taken advantage of was quite high. I'm not too sure the naive and vulnerability thing, I think, maybe comes from her not having experienced being a teenager.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She never got the chance to kind of be around her peers and learn how to function in that way. So I think maybe because they didn't expound on what they meant by that. So I'm not going to either. So at the age of 25, Sandra came to her family and told them she was pregnant. Now, Sarah, this is so fucking upsetting. Sandra was excited at the prospect of being a mum, and so too were her brothers and sisters. Bridie was especially excited to be an auntie and was with Sandra the day she delivered her baby. Sandra loved being a mother and adored her child. They lived together in Anne's small cottage, but after 6 months, pressure from Anne, who did not want the baby in the house, led to a devastating decision that Sandra had to make.
She put that baby up for adoption?
Yep.
Are you serious?
Nope. I'm 100% serious. Sandra spoke.
Sorry, I know you're talking about this family, and I know that some, like, they're still around, but, like, she cared for this woman.
Yep. Sandra spoke to her sister, telling her she did not think Anne's cottage was the adequate place to raise a child, that she wanted to give her child the chance of having the loving, secure life she had with her siblings and her parents. Sandra had decided to give her baby up for adoption. Now, here's what bothers me.
Go on.
When she said, I don't think this house is right for a baby. The fact that her aunt didn't say, you should move out and raise that baby somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like, this pissed me off. This is fucking nuts. I don't care what year this is. This is crazy behavior. That poor girl was so, like, fucking Stockholm syndromed. But she was like, I can't leave my aunt. I have to give my child up.
Yeah.
It was a big loss to us all, Bridie told Maru in her mask. Sandra explained it as best she could that it was something she had to do. As the family reeled from the adoption of Anne's baby, another tragedy befell them. In February of 2000, so months before Sandra's disappearance, James Collins, Sandra's brother, was killed when a machine he was using in work crushed his leg. James was alone, and a significant loss of blood led to his death. The family once again were utterly devastated, with their father calling it the worst night of his life. Mary, the youngest of the Collins, said she was too young to understand what happened to her brother, but later learning that he died alone was too much for her to comprehend. Only 10 months later, the family would be met with yet another horrific tragedy. On Sunday, December 3rd, the day before Sandra's disappearance, Sandra and her Aunt Anne made their usual visit to the Collins home. It was Bridie's birthday and Sandra had brought her a card, which she signed when she arrived. Patrick told the Journal that Sandra was in a great mood. She told her mother she would see her next Sunday and that she hoped that she wasn't too cross with her that she didn't have a present. She was chatting away. She was talking about Christmas, he said. That Sunday was Bridie's birthday, but sadly she had already left the house to go on a night out and missed seeing Sandra. December 3rd would be the last time Sandra's family would see her alive. Patrick watched her walk out the front door, put her aunt in the car and drive off into the dark. On December 5th, Bridie arrived home from work at 7 p.m. She called Anne to check if everything was okay in the house once Sandra had returned. She presumed Sandra had returned. She didn't come home, Anne told her. Bridie felt a dart of panic run through her, but steadied herself. Did you fall out? Was there an argument? She asked. Anne told her no, that they were on fine terms when Sandra left to go to the shop. Bridie put down the phone, gathered her parents together, put them in the car, and the three of them drove to Anne's house. When they arrived and spoke to Anne, the decision was made to call the Gardaí.
Okay.
The family tried to remain calm as Gardaí visited anywhere they believed Sandra may have gone that night, and they also spoke to people in the town, in the shops and pubs, to inquire if they'd seen Sandra. Now, bear in mind, there's 600 people in this village. It's not big. This is smaller than where I live, where my mom lives. So it would have been easy enough to go around being like, have any of you seen Sandra? Like, do you know what I mean? It would have been not a difficult thing to find out where she was. So on December 6th, when Sandra still had not returned home, word began to spread around the community that she was missing. An extensive search began with the Gardaí leading and the small village of Killala coming out in force to help. The reality of what was happening began to hit the Collins family. Although Bridie hoped that Sandra may have just gotten on a bus and decided to start a new life for herself. Like, it's so fucking sad that her sister was like, I hope she just got on a bus and went somewhere else to get out of the situation that she's in. She knew deep down something was very, very wrong. The sea became the focus for the Gardaí. Sub-aqua teams were sent into the waters to search for any clues, or more devastatingly, to search for where they believed Sandra's body may be. Sandra's family were terrified. It felt like a waking nightmare. Their community rallied around them, cooking food and making tea. They also learned that Sandra had been exceptionally kind to people in the area and there was a massive outpouring of love for her. 5 days after Sandra went missing, the family received a call from the Gardaí. An item of clothing had been found on the pier and they believed it belonged to Sandra. The pink fleece, which Bridie confirmed was Sandra's, was found muddied and discarded in a puddle. Inside the pockets were a pound of sausages, which Sandra had bought the night she disappeared, and two pieces of paper. On one piece of paper was a man's name and a phone number. On the second were three phone numbers with no names beside them. When the Gardaí cross-referenced the first number, they discovered it belonged to a local man who was married with three children named Martin Early. The phone numbers on the second piece were for abortion clinics in the UK.
Oh.
As news of the discovery swept the village, theories arose that perhaps Sandra had taken her own life. She had given away her child and lost her brother in a very short space of time, and maybe it all became too much for her. Gardaí asked the family if Sandra had seemed depressed or ever spoken about suicidal ideation, and they were told no, never. Knowing her the way we knew her, Bridie told Maru in her mask, she would never have done that. Bridie did not believe what happened to Sandra was suicide or an accident. And she questioned, which is like what I questioned, how the fleece was not found for 5 days, considering searches had been done up and down the pier. Surely someone would have seen it, which is absolutely fucking true. They were up and down that pier, including the family members, for 5 days.
Yeah.
Nothing there. And she was like, we knew what that fleece looked like. We would have known it was Sandra's. And then all of a sudden, overnight, there's a fleece there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe somebody had done something, Bridie said. And they came back and placed the fleece on the pier to make it look like suicide. The Collins now also had to contend with the fact that Sandra had been pregnant the day she disappeared. When Gardaí spoke to Sandra's DP, he told them that Sandra had visited him on the 1st of December. And then 3 days later, she had disappeared. He had given her a pregnancy test, which was positive. She told the GP that she wished to have a termination and would be travelling to England to do so. Gardaí also spoke to witnesses who had seen Sandra earlier on the 4th, acting erratically in a phone booth in the town. When Gardaí checked what numbers had been called that day, Martin Early, the man whose name was on the piece of paper found in Sandra's pocket, was dialed several times, and he had in fact dialed into the phone box also.
Okay.
So further theories arose around this information. People believe that maybe she had travelled to the UK for an abortion and just had not returned. Others believe she may have taken her life after learning that she was pregnant. Gardaí spoke to Early and he denied having an affair with Sandra, that they were just friends. However, 6 months later, when the Gardaí questioned him again, he admitted to having a relationship with Sandra in the weeks leading up to her death. So Early, from Banagher, Caramore-Lachan in Ballina, met Sandra in 2000, the year 2000, in a pub, and initially they had struck up a friendship. One night they walked home together and began kissing in an alleyway. He said that Sandra had told him she thought he was single, but then admitted she knew that he had a wife. So on the December 1st, 3 days before Sandra disappeared, the two left a pub, went to Early's high ace van, which was parked in a central car park, and had sex. And he said he used protection, obviously, to be like,
not my baby.
Not my baby. This was the second occasion that we had full intercourse, Early said in his statement. And I always wore a condom.
Lies.
No, you didn't. Early admitted to Gardaí.
Allegedly.
Sorry. Early admitted to Gardaí that he had spoken to Sandra on the phone on December 4th and she had contacted him from a phone box. She listened to this. She said she had something to tell me, that she was in a small bit of trouble, that she was expecting a baby for about 2 months and that it, quote, had nothing to do with him. She asked,
how thick is this motherfucker?
She asked for a few pounds as she did not want to go through another pregnancy and said that she would need £1,000. I was shocked because she never told me she was pregnant, but I didn't take her request for money as a threat. She simply asked for help and I would help to a certain extent, Early's statement read. Now, okay. Why would she call him?
Sorry, can I just, did this man speak to a solicitor before he went in there?
This is a statement, so I presume so.
Yeah, because, like, that thing of, like, it wasn't, I didn't,
and it was nothing to do with
as a threat. Yeah. And it was nothing, that's a very specific, use of language.
He's covering every base of an argument that someone could give him. Like, the first argument being, well, why would she call you? It must have been your baby. No, she said on the phone it was nothing to do with me. OK, but she asked you for money. Did you think that that was like a threat? No, it wasn't a threat. I never took it as a threat. So even before he could be questioned on those statements, all the answers were in his statement.
Yeah.
You know, Early said the last time he physically saw Sandra was December 1st and that he had initially lied to the Gardaí in order to protect his marriage. And that seemed to suit the Gardaí just fine, and Sandra's case went cold.
Are you serious?
For almost 10 years, the Collins family lay in wait that Sandra would return, every day becoming more and more difficult. The not knowing sometimes felt worse than the inevitable. I would come home from work every evening at 7 p.m., Bridie said. I would turn the key in the door and just hold my breath, hoping she would be there when I walked in. I cannot imagine that. That must be... I can't fathom that in my brain.
I can't fathom is, so like, this is a case and I'm not related to these people and I don't know these people. And the end of this is going to bother me.
Yes.
Right. The idea that something hasn't got a finite resolution.
Yeah.
Oh my God, when I tell you,
drive
that
you insane.
In itself would drive me insane. Yeah. But then to add the emotion of it being someone you love and someone you like, care about, and someone that you shared your secrets with, and someone that you feel now you've let down because you don't know what happened to them, you don't know why they didn't come to you, all of that, and then just the want and the grief to see the people that you, like, it's like when someone dies.
Someone dies.
And you, all you want is to see them. That's it. Like, you just want to see them. You give anything to see them. And then the idea that you don't know if they're dead or alive.
Oh, man.
So you don't know, like, you know, because when someone's dead and you've got that grief and all you want to do is see them, the other part of your brain is like, well, that's not possible. You don't have that other part of your brain going, that's not possible, because the other part of your brain is going, well, maybe they're still, like, we don't know they're dead.
Like, hope can be a suffocating thing. Like, hope can be worse. I feel, and this is maybe very dramatic, hope can be sometimes worse
than knowing.
Than knowing.
Yeah.
The hope there that you're like, maybe. That
it's,
can be,
you know, it's like, we've all been there when you've had a, like, a partner and you've broken up and you've been dumped, or you've been like something, and you're not the one that, like, you're a hope, that hope, oh, it's fixable. That hope, oh, we get back together. That hope, oh, maybe it's I hope, like, we can work through that. Like, that hope, add that onto, like, the hope of someone still being alive and them not hurt.
I couldn't imagine it. Like, I can't imagine these cases of somebody disappearing, like, it's somebody being murdered is horrific, don't get me wrong, horrific, I can't imagine that either, but coming home every evening and standing at the door and being like, maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, so as the Collins continued to mourn their sister and daughter, in 2003 their mother Eleanor was diagnosed with terminal cancer and passed away. As the children sat at her bedside and she told them she would not live to see Sandra coming home, that she would, but that she would try to send her home when she was in heaven.
Oh, Jesus.
Eleanor Collins passed away in 2004. So they had lost their brother, their sister, and their mother in the space of 4 years. The Collins and the Killala community refused to let Sandra be forgotten and regularly placed posters in the area requesting that anyone with information could please come forward. Bridie told Maru in her mask that for 10 years she had hoped that maybe her sister was still alive, but this was dashed in 2010 when Detective Superintendent Peter O'Boyle took over the investigation into Sandra's disappearance. O'Boyle reclassified Sandra's case from a missing person to murder. The basis of this was no proof of life, no financial or other transactions, and no sightings. He also did not believe that Sandra had taken her own life through drowning, as her body never washed up. And usually, regardless of how, you know, held down they are, if somebody decided to murder her and, like, tie rocks to her or whatever the fuck these weirdos do, her body never turned up. Ever.
Yeah.
Due to the reclassification, another large-scale investigation was carried out. Witnesses who were previously interviewed were interviewed again, with the hopes of new or potentially hidden information coming to light. It was understood that the investigators believed Sandra had been murdered and her body buried in a shallow grave. The Collins had lost all hope of ever seeing Sandra alive again. It was devastating and utterly heartbreaking, but now they wanted the person who had taken their sister from them to be brought to justice. So at 5 p.m. on Thursday, the 27th of December, 2012, a 48-year-old man from Ballina was arrested in connection with the murder of Sandra Collins. And this man was Martin Early.
Okay.
Early had been arrested two other times, in March of 2011 and December of 2011, but was released each time. So they were kind of trying to get him, but they couldn't. Early pleaded not guilty at Ballina District Court. Although the news was deeply upsetting for the family, there seemed to be a light at the end of the tunnel in finding out what had happened to Sandra. I couldn't imagine seeing somebody who had done this to my sister, Mary told Maru in her mask. I don't know how I'm going to be in the same room as that person. Then I just thought, I'm doing it for Sandra because she needs us to do this for her. She needs a voice. So on the 29th of April, Martin Early's trial began. Evidence was brought forward that Early had known Sandra, had a relationship with her, and had interacted with her on the day of her disappearance. On the 11th day of the trial, Michael Grenahan, a friend of Early's,
told Joseph Patrick McCarthy and the jury that Martin Early had visited his home on March 23rd, 2011 and was very upset. He told Michael he was in quote, in trouble. Excuse me. Michael said Martin had called him earlier that day before arriving at his home and he, quote, sounded very panicky and sounded like he had a few beers. Michael told Martin to get some sleep. So he took him in. He was like, listen, you're fucking, I don't know what's wrong with you, but you're really all over the place. So he said, get some sleep, put him in a room. And then when he went into the room the next morning to ask why he was so upset the previous night, Early told him he was in big trouble and it was in relation to Sandra Collins. Grenahan said Early told him, he told Early to go home and then to go and speak to the Gardaí. Early kept talking and Grenahan said he told him that he was with Sandra the night she disappeared, that the two had gone to the pier in Killala together. Here they got into an argument and Sandra had gotten out of his car upset and erratic, slipped and fell into the water.
Lies.
When Grenahan asked Early why he didn't jump in to save Sandra, Early told him he could not swim and it was very dark that night. So you couldn't go get help?
No.
You couldn't go to the side of the pier where there's obviously one of those, you know, the round life buoys and throw it into the water to her? Grenahan said he told Martin to go home, speak to his wife, call his solicitor and then go to the Gardaí. I know this man was like, get the fuck out of my house.
Yeah.
Get out of my gaff. I don't want anything to do with this. Like, so when cross-examined, Michael Grenahan said that Early was a good father, a non-violent person, and he truly believed that Early was telling the truth when he said Sandra slipped into the water.
What?
Yeah. So he was like, this happened, but I don't think he meant to do it. It was an accident. Despite the evidence at hand, on the fifth week of the trial, the judge told the jury that they must find Martin Early not guilty of the murder of Sandra Collins.
What?
So this is from RTE. Mr. Justice Patrick McCarthy said that while he was of the view that Miss Collins had died on the night of 4th of December 2000, in his view, there was insufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime of murder had been convicted. So on the 5th of June 2014, Michael Early was acquitted and walked from court a free man.
Are you serious?
Yep.
Well, I suppose it is, like, it is, from a legal perspective, it is hearsay.
It is
There's
hearsay.
No evidence.
Yeah, it is only, but the other side of that is why in the name of God would that man, that Michael Grenahan man, come forward and say that? Like, there is no reason, rhyme or reason, that man could have shut his mouth and said nothing until the day he died. What possible reason would that man have to come forward other than his guilt was eating him alive?
Yeah.
So the Collins family were once again dealt a devastating blow. However, in a statement, they said, quote, that they recognize and appreciate the judge's decision and acknowledge the legal rights of the accused. Very mature. Very understanding for a family to say those things.
Yeah.
Although once again, in a tailspin of heartbreak and confusion, the family were more determined than ever to keep Sandra's memory alive. And on Sunday, August 16th, 2015, the family unveiled a plaque at Killala Bay. As it was unveiled, Sandra's father stood beside it with tears in his eyes and gently touched her picture. The plaque reads, Sandra Collins, a missing sister, a missing daughter, all together but one. We travel, we search, we pray, we cry. No answers, no leads, no reason why. Years have passed, forever we remember the times we shared before December. On February 22nd, 2016, Joseph Collins, Sandra's stepfather, passed away from cancer. When Dad's condition deteriorated, Patrick said, he said to me, will you promise me something? And I said, I will. He said, will you find her? And I said, who? The nurse. Do you want me to get the nurse? He said, no, I'm not talking about the nurse. I want you to promise me to find Sandra. If I die and I'm not here, don't you ever give up looking for her until you find her. The Collins kept their promise to their father and continued to search for answers to Sandra's murder. But Patrick wants people to know they are not seeking revenge. We just want to find her, he said. We don't want to send anybody to jail. I don't want to ruin anybody's life. If the person that murdered Sandra knocked on the door and said, hello, and I answered the door and they said, here's your sister, and walked off on their way, I would let them go. Then I could ring the funeral director and wake her here like we wanted to do for so long. I'm not out for vengeance. I don't know which is worse, Sandra being murdered and taken from us, or the fact that they've hidden her body and we've been on this search for the past 16 years. We need to bring her home. That is the case of Sandra Collins. And what I'm going to do is, her family have a website set up just in Sandra's memory and for anybody to give information. So I'm going to make sure that I post all of that information in the show notes just so people can have a look. The fact that this happened in a village of 657 people mm-hmm. and nobody knows where this girl is or what happened to her is so fucking infuriating. And, you know, there's a detective that worked on the case who is now retired that said he believes and he knows that people in the village know what happened to Sandra, and they're just not talking because there's a fear there that they're going to get in trouble or they're going to upset the wrong people or something bad is going to happen. And I know from, and you know, from living in areas where secrets are kept, it's the most infuriating thing on the planet. Like, somebody is dead. A family are in mourning. They've lost both their parents, their brother and their fucking sister. Their brother and sister in tragic circumstances. And they've no answers. They have to go to a courtroom and be told by a judge, we don't have enough evidence. We can't do anything. Like, this is horrific. Like, and somebody knows something, Sarah. And that's not me just being like, oh, somebody fucking knows something. Somebody does not disappear from a village with 657 fucking people, where people know what you ate for dinner. They're buried up your arse 24 hours a day, but they don't know where a young girl, a 29-year-old girl is. Like, it's frustrating, but her family are remarkable. They're incredibly strong. And I just want to extend my sympathies to them. Her brother, Patrick, actually did a really good podcast, which I will link here as well, talking about Sandra. It's excellent. He's such a lovely guy. But yeah, I these cases of like smaller villages, I like doing them because I grew up in one. So things have happened in the village that I live in. Things have happened. And anybody from my village who's listening to this will know what I'm talking about. Things have happened in this village where people in this village have not said anything. When I say things, I mean the most horrific shit that you could ever possibly imagine happening to children. And it's shh, don't talk about it. Shh, shh. Don't mention that name. Don't say their name because everybody's afraid of them. And then these horrific acts happen to the family members. And then it's shocking and sad and terrible. But I'm like, nobody said anything. You know, so these cases really hit home for me and they frustrate the fuck out of me as well. And her being 16 years of age, caring for her sick aunt, never having a childhood, not being able to finish school. I don't know, man. But anyway, that is Sandra's case. And as I said, I will link all information to her family's websites and everything like that. And, you know, I mean, obviously, there's nothing we can do. We live down here. But like, if anybody is listening to this from that area and knows anybody who knows anything, please help these people. Like, they don't deserve to suffer like this. They just don't. But so that's this week's terribleness.
That is a terrible story. And like, I don't know how that man is like, I just want to know. And I won't I don't think I have that kind of like, that's not empathy. Like, that's like a level of like, I just don't have it in my heart. Like, you know what I mean?
Like,
Graham can only insignificantly murder me, and I'd be like, I'm gonna murder you!
We would be like, I want this cunt dead. Like, you know, but they've been suffering for so long that all they care about is getting her back. That's all they care about.
Yeah.
They want to bury their sister. They want to say goodbye to her. Like, they can't say goodbye to her. I don't know. The whole thing is fucked. Like, the whole thing. I was so mad when I was, because I was, the thing that made me mad, her disappearance makes me mad, but her life before her disappearance makes me mad. And the fact that she wasn't given a chance. She had to give up a baby.
Yeah.
That she didn't want to give up. What the fuck is wrong with Ireland? Oh, I don't know. Like, six months, Sarah, she'd bonded with that child.
I don't know how she did that.
And, like, her life was so Stockholm syndromed that she was like, I can't keep this baby because I can't let my aunt down.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Anyway, that's their family. I'm not judging. Please don't anybody think I'm judging them, because we grew up in this country and we understand this shit and how putting this pressure on children. And like, my mum was, 14 when she left school as well to go work. Do you know what I mean?
My mom was this, well, my mom was out by 14 to look after her mom, like, and then got
crazy.
A job.
Like Lily in 4 years was like, I have to leave school and go live with my aunt.
Yeah. And then my mom was pregnant within 2 years of that.
And that was a lot of that was what was happening as well, because they had no education on sexuality, Sarah.
Yeah.
They had no education on how to protect themselves. They had no education on, like, these men are not good men. Not saying that your dad's not a good man. That's not what I mean. These men
isn't. And we never talk about it.
But we don't protect these girls from these older men who know, oh, these young girls haven't got any education and they're not being protected. They're being treated like adults. I'm going to step in here and get what I need out of them. Like, those conversations weren't being had. So many of these 15 and 16 year olds who had to leave school ended up pregnant.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm angry. I need to calm down. It's Valentine's Day.
I get it. Like, I absolutely get the anger. Like, it's not... But I think also the anger is very much like, this is how... This is Ireland. This happened because it's Ireland. And the idea as well that you got pregnant out of wedlock or you had an affair and then you were pregnant. Like, that was the ruination of women.
Of course it is.
And you would be seen as, like, they're... And, you like, that... prevailed for a lot longer in areas that weren't urbanized, like Dublin in Ireland. Like, there's still areas where it's like, she's pregnant.
Like, and it's so funny because it's I wouldn't even, that would, I'm bad now. If someone was like, this is Mary, she's 20 and she's pregnant, I'd be like, congratulations. Like, it's not even like, but it's so funny because I'd be like, you were a child. 20 years
I'd
old.
Be like, you You're whore.
Throw holy water on them. The power of Christ compels you.
You whore!
Get this harlot out of here.
Oh my God.
But yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I feel for her family. And I know I always say this at the end of every case, but I just feel for the families in these matters. And I'm not judging them. They were in a country where everything was set up that you were constantly being martyred. You had no peace. Suffering was the only way to live. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, it's so frustrating. But I'm sending love to the Collinses, and I hope that they do find the peace that they're looking for. I really, really do. So, also, I was going to say to you, I'm going to try and contact. I think it'd be interesting to maybe speak to some families if they wanted to speak to us.
Oh yeah,
about these cases. Just that we've spoken about them, and just to kind of talk to them and see, you know, if there's anything we can do to further help in any way, or just to, I know a lot of people wouldn't want to speak to us, but if anybody is listening to, because we've had a couple of people, if anybody is listening to these episodes and their family members and they want to talk about their family, please contact us, because I will be more than happy, and I'm sure Sarah Jane will be, to talk to you about it. Because I don't ever want this podcast to become us just telling what happened. Bye bye. Like, you know, it's, these people have real families and real lives in Ireland. As I said, it's tiny. So, but yeah, go on. Listen, I'll let you go back to work. I'm going to go. I think my mum is gone. I don't know where she is. But yeah, I'm going to have a shower. I'll talk to you soon, honey. Okay.
Bye.
Thanks for hanging out.
I was doing next to nothing about a year ago, when Sarah Jane and Emma came a knocking on my door. Said they'd figured out a better way to pass the time and do a little podcast researching true crime. They wanted hoodies, cats and bees, the kind of place where men are not allowed. They wanted hoodies, cats and bees. On Sunday night, Sarah Jane would come around, lay a story down. And just about when everything was going as planned, Sarah Jane and Emma started making demands. You're gonna have to edit out for what we said, so I'll only record if we're sitting on a bed. Ooh, these cats and bees, with a lifetime supply of Jenny Glow. They won't. Homicide, some Army Hammer Joes, and a song to end the show.